Golf Smarter number 598 is brought to you by Radio Baseball Cards. If you're a fan of baseball, especially if you love the history of baseball, you'll get a kick of our latest podcast. This week's episode features one of the few players who spent his entire career with one team and led them to the World Series victory. Hall of Famer Al Kaline of the Detroit Tigers went directly from high school into the major leagues and had an instant impact. In this episode, despite 18 All-Star appearances, 10 Gold Gloves, and getting his number retired, Kaline shares his greatest thrill in baseball. Find Radio Baseball Cards at smarterpodcasts.com or subscribe for free and get each new episode delivered automatically from iTunes, the Apple Podcast app, Overcast, SoundCloud, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. How to determine the best set of tees for you to play from using rating, slope, and yardage with Jim Cowan.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, Jim.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm just fine.
I'm glad to have you on the show today because you're going to be able to answer some questions that I've been asking for many, many years. And today we're going to talk about the handicap system, rating and slope, and how courses determine which holes are, you know, the number one handicap hole and what that means. These are things that we ask all the time. And I think the biggest thing that we're not really sure of is, when you play a new course, how do you determine which tee boxes you should play from? What do these numbers all mean in relation to my game?
Well, there's a number of factors that someone should look at. One, I think, would be yardage. Yardage is still king as far as course rating is concerned. So find a length of tees that you're comfortable with. The course rating is basically a number indicating the expected score of a scratch golfer, a zero handicapper playing those tees. If they were to play 20 rounds, their best 10 would average that number. The slope rating kind of tells you proportionately how much more difficult that set of tees plays for high handicappers versus low handicappers. I like to say how much the trouble on the golf course tends to gang up on a low handicapper with some of the troubles. So those are some of the factors that you look at. Find a yardage that's comfortable, find some ratings that's comfortable. If you have a high, relatively high course rating, low slope, that would imply that it's long, but there's not a lot of trouble, not a lot of things that you have to carry. If the yardage is short, it carries a low rating, and a high slope, that would imply that there's all sorts of trouble out there just waiting for the bogey player.
Oh, I wish I would say, okay, perfect, got it all now, because I'm still even more confused. I've never understood why people get so locked into the yardage, and you're saying yardage is king, but that doesn't tell me how difficult a course is, does it? It just tells me how long it is.
Well,
from the back tees, you know, from each set of tees.
I think it tells you on one level the type of clubs that you can expect to hit that day. And, you know, personally, in the old days when I was a better player, I used to look at a scorecard, and if I saw the tees were 6,800 yards, I might be okay with that if it had a couple of long par fives and a couple of long par threes. But if it was a steady course of 450-yard par fours, you know, I kind of tell myself I'm not going to have fun playing those tees, hitting long irons or utility clubs into those greens. So I think on the one hand, it tells you, you know, what you can expect in terms of approach shots and what sort of clubs you might be hitting and what sort of clubs you might be comfortable with. You know, everybody wants a shot at a couple of birdies. Everyone wants to hit some greens in regulation. And if you're tackling yardage that's too long, you're not really going to get that opportunity. But as to the difficulty standpoint, you know, we get calls from clubs that maybe made some modifications to their course, or, hey, we put in a couple of new bunkers, we need you to come out and take a look at the rating, or we lost some trees in a storm and we need to have you look at that. And those really don't add up to a whole lot as far as a rating. It probably takes 10 points when we're rating worth of bunkers to push the needle a tenth of a stroke in the course rating. And yet, if I were to add 20, 30, 40 yards to a particular hole, we know that all the scoring averages of low handicappers and high handicappers are going to go up. You know, just putting in a bunker is not really going to push the needle. Raising the green speed by a foot really isn't going to do much. Raising the rough height by an inch, you know, is going to have some effect, but for a particular hole, it's really not going to change anything. But if you add 40 yards, we're going to see across the board predictable increases in the scores of golfers. So from that standpoint, yardage is king. And by that, I mean every 22 yards basically represents a tenth of a stroke for the scratch golfer on the men's side, every 16 yards for the bogey player. So it doesn't take much to add up in terms of adding to difficulty through yardage.
I can't write this fast. I'm trying to take notes furiously from what you're saying. Every 22 yards adds a tenth of a stroke for a scratch golfer? Is that what you said?
Yep.
And so,
yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Okay. So it can be quantified. So then, and for a bogey golfer, how many yards?
It's every 16 yards.
16 yards. And that's total distance.
Yeah. So one of the things that we ran into a decade or two ago was new courses were being built at that time. We're not seeing a lot of them built now, but yeah. As they're being built, you know, modern technology in terms of building tees and everything, just beautiful, you know, launching pads for tees. A lot of them were very long, and of course, instinctively wanted the measurements to appear on their scorecard to be just a couple of steps from the back edge, when that isn't really where that hole was being played from. And if someone's building 20-something yard long tee pads and it's only going to host the blue tee or the white tee, and they want the measurement base from a couple of paces from the back just so that they can advertise their courses this long, that's going to skew the course rating and skew the handicaps of anyone who is playing there often, because you know, you'd like to think that the average point that hole is going to be played from is the middle of the tee pad, and then they can spread the wear and tear around that pad. So if you're talking 10 yards a hole, that's 180 yards for the course. That's almost a stroke. And if you ask a golfer, hey, are you interested in picking up another 8-9 tenths in your handicap, they're going to say, yeah, of course I am. So we had to start insisting that clubs – that we're going to base the rating and we're going to base the official measurements on the midpoint of tee pads. If one tee pad is just hosting one set of tees, and if a tee pad is shared, blue and white shared, then we look at how much play is there from white, how much from blue. Typically, you're going to see a lot more from white. So we would dedicate more of that tee pad to white than blue, and then we'd find the midpoints of those sections and call that the official measurement and base the official rating from that point. So that's how much yardage can impact. But, you know, yardage isn't everything. And again, if you see a low course rating, a very high slope, that's telling you that there's a lot of trouble, probably trouble that has to be carried. Bogey golfers have problems with carrying water off a tee, carrying fescue off a tee, like in Erin Hills, things of that nature. So that's telling you that a lot of the trouble is ganging up on this bogey player.
I see. And so if it's reverse and you have a high rating and a low slope, and so give me some numbers to make me understand. If I said high rating, low slope.
Oh, maybe 71, 72 rating and a slope in the low 120s. That implies that that there's not a lot out there, that it's just long holes that don't have a lot of trouble, probably lacking water, probably lacking out of bounds, probably lacking deep bunkers, perhaps big greens that are, you know, easy to get on. Things of that nature. The other thing that's a little interesting about slope, since it's telling you the proportionate difficulty between a scratch and a higher handicapper, One phenomenon we see is if it's a fairly short set of tees for men, 6,000 yards or whatever, we've got a lot of holes that our bogey golfer can hit in regulation, but he might be coming into those greens with a long iron or a utility club, whereas Scratch is coming in with a pitch shot, a wedge. And so any of that greenside trouble is really ganging up on the bogey player. They're going to be more apt to miss the green, hit it in the bunkers, have to recover from the bunker, or have to deal with the tough chip shots that are around the green because, again, Scratch is coming in with a wedge. We would expect him from a short distance to a good-sized green to be able to hit the green almost every time. Bogey isn't. So sometimes when we have a fairly short set of tees, it might have a healthy slope rating, and that's an indication that bogey's going to be able to hit a lot of greens in regulation. And then perhaps if we add a few hundred yards to those tees, we find that certainly the course rating goes up, but maybe slope doesn't go up so much. Maybe some of these holes that bogey could reach from the white tees with a long iron or utility club, now it becomes a three-shot hole for them. They can't reach it in regulation, but they can easily chip or pitch it on in three and get a relatively easy bogey. So to some degree, some of the relative difficulty is moving away from Scratch in that case because they're not going to be subject to all the greenside trouble. So that can explain why sometimes the rating goes up a fair amount from white to blue, but you know, slope only goes up a few points. Bogey's probably scoring the same bogey on the hole from white or blue. It's just that from blue, he can't reach the green. He's able to chip or pitch it on and get a relatively easy two-putt and walk on to the next hole.
Give me an example of what a low rating is and what a high rating is.
Well, again, it's a lot of that is based on yardage, but, you know, 67, 68, things like that are implying that you're playing some pretty short tees, you know, probably less than 6,000 yards. And when you start getting into 72, 73, 74 or more, that's implying that you're above the 6,500-yard mark. And certainly we have a lot of courses in Northern California that push 7,000. So just on yardage alone, those are going to carry a high course rating. Again, slope ratings is a different matter because when we rate, we literally look at each and every shot on the golf course through the eyes of a scratch golfer and a bogey golfer. So we're told how far both players hit the ball. We'll proceed that far off the tee, look at the landing zone, how wide is the fairway, what's the lie like here, are there fairway bunkers nearby, what are they like, are there trees nearby, how difficult are they to recover from, do we have lateral water, do we have out of bounds, things like that. And we do that for each landing zone for both golfers, and then we get to the green and examine the greenside trouble, what percentage of the green is surrounded by bunkers, how deep are they. Do you have to carry them to get to the green surface? What happens if you miss the green? Is it a routine up and down, or is it a very challenging up and down with elevated greens and slope greens? And then what's the putting surface like? What's the green speeds? Things like that. So that's what we do for both a scratch golfer and a 20 handicapper. And that's what leads us to our slope rating. It's the gap between the scratch rating and the bogey rating, how many strokes apart they are, that determines the slope rating. So the wider the gap, the higher the slope rating, the narrower the gap, the lower the slope rating that's applied to those set of tees.
What we didn't establish is who the heck you are. How do you all know all this stuff? So why don't you tell us what your position is with whom?
Yeah, well, my name is Jim Cowan, and I'm the Director of Course Rating and Handicapping for the Northern California Golf Association. So this is my 23rd season, course rating season here with the NCGA. And prior to that, I worked for the Oregon Golf Association, New Jersey State Golf Association, and then Pacific Northwest Golf Association in my native Washington. So, you know, I've been rating golf courses for more than 30 years and seeing a lot of the changes to the system, the advent of the slope system, which made handicap's a little more portable and allowed you to travel to course and receive more strokes at really tough courses and maybe forfeit strokes at easy courses. So, that's my background, and I oversee the handicap and course rating services of the NCGA.
Oh, so if you've been around during the implementation of the slope system, then you must know Dean Knuth.
Absolutely. Dean's a good friend. Just got an email from him last week.
Well, he was just on last week's show as well. We've had him on numerous times. And actually, he told me that you knew each other, and he said, ask him about the World Handicap System.
Well, that...
Am I allowed to ask you about that?
we're working on a world handicap system. The USGA and the RNA are heading that up, and representatives from many other countries are involved in it. So I know that by this September at the Walker Cup matches at Los Angeles Country Club, the expectation is that there's going to be a big announcement about many of the details. Eventually, it's going to be the same as the rules of golf. You know, they have a period of time where they put out this information and then they're looking for public comment on that. That's what they're doing right now with the rules of golf. And mm-hmm. then the RNA and the USGA will digest that information, and then they're going to come out to, you know, with their finalized version of the updated rules of golf in 2019. We're not quite to that area with the world world handicap system yet, but the timetable says that this September there'll be a big announcement with a lot of details. And I don't know, perhaps by next year they will make a number of these announcements and then ask for public comment on a lot of the features. So the way I look at it, it's kind of a reboot of the system. That I think Americans are going to recognize the vast majority of the new system, but we've been able to tap into some of the best features of other systems across the world. There are five primary handicap systems across the world. So one thing that was announced in a Wall Street Journal article a couple of years ago that I can say that I think golfers can agree on and say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, is that there's going to be a feature that's going to analyze scores posted each day. And if they see that something unusual was going on and the scores have spiked for the day or the scores have dipped for the day, there's going to be, in effect, an adjustment to the course rating that day. So working here in Pebble Beach at Poppy Hills, you know, for years and years we have had a lot of our tournaments at Spyglass, and I can tell you that when we used to have our zone championships there in March, you might have a day where it's raining sideways and a score of 85 in, you know, monsoon conditions is certainly much better than a score of 85 from the same set of tees on a calm day. And this adjustment is going to be able to recognize that and say, hey, we need to adjust the rating basically for this day and tweak the rating a little bit to account for either the tougher or the easier conditions. So it wasn't designed for this, but I almost think one of the side benefits is going to be, you know, we've been locked in historic droughts for a few years, and some golf courses having to turn off some of their fairways, getting firmer, scores perhaps coming down. It would be able to recognize things like that too, that, hey, something was going on that made the scores lower. We're going to adjust in effect the rating for that day and try to reflect that. On the other hand, it's going to be able to account for maybe it was the biggest tournament of the year at a golf course and they went with all the toughest hole locations. They took a little water off the greens and double cut them. They grew the rough a little bit longer. The course was playing tougher. The system is going to be able to recognize that. So, that's one feature that is going to be added to the system above and beyond what we have in the handicap system here in the United States right now.
I feel like we got a scoop here on something that's going to be happening. Remember a couple of years ago when the writer Thomas Friedman came out with the book and it became a very popular phrase, the world is flat?
Yes.
I guess now, once this gets implemented, we'll be able to say the world has a rating in slope. Right?
The
world is undulating.
Right. It's already been agreed upon that the USGA course rating system will be the base for all courses in the world. So one of the representatives on this committee is from Japan, and I asked him last year when I first met him how many courses they had and how many still needed to be rated under the USGA system. And they still have about 700 courses to rate in a short period of time. Argentina is represented on the committee. They have their own handicap system at this time, and I know that they need some help in getting their courses rated in time for the advent to the World Handicap System. So there are some areas, but it's been agreed upon that that will be the base course rating system, because right now there are different course rating systems around the world too. So, the committee's trying to work on the mathematics. It's been very interesting participating in this process, just learning the different golf cultures in different countries. In Australia, for example, Stableford is such a common form of play that when you get done with your round, you don't necessarily post that you shot 85. You say how many points you had that round. Their system is geared towards the input of Stableford points. In Europe, they post very few scores at this point in time. One of the representatives on the committee, I asked him how many rounds of golf he played last year. He said 70. I said, how many of those do you post towards your handicap? He said 3. And that doesn't mean he's doing something wrong. It's just that's how their system works. They designate certain days that this will be a day that counts towards your handicap, and all other rounds that you play in between don't. And they kind of recognize that that's a little too stringent. You know, if you have a golfer as he's getting older and older and their game is deteriorating, that's not enough input for the decline in his game, you know, for the handicap to match the decline. So they recognize they need to post more scores, but they look almost in some horror at how our system wants all the scores we can get, whether it's just a casual round with the wife and kids or your buddies, and certain forms of play, match play, they're not keen on, partnership formats they're not keen on. So it's trying to bridge the gap and find the happy medium between the two, and again, take advantage of the finer points or some of the really neat things that these other systems have to make a unified system that's better than what any of us have at this point.
So to create this unified system all over the world, you're saying that the USGA is going to be like the leading system or the light at the end of the tunnel, where everyone's kind of going towards the U.S. system?
Or no, somewhere in between. Yeah. Somewhere in between. So the USGA and the RNA are sponsoring this just like they do amateur status, just like they do the rules of golf. And so, again, it's most Americans will recognize the vast majority of the new system. Some things will change. Equitable stroke control will likely change a little bit. The mathematics might change slightly. It's not going to impact drastically the scores that we post. Still, we will want, you know, scores from a recreational round. We'll still want those to be posted. We'll still have the concept of peer review, which means, you know, the absolute right that I have to view your scores to make sure you're posting them and posting them accurately, and the right that you have to view my scoring record. So most of it will be recognizable. There'll just be some additions like this adjustment on a daily basis for conditions that will be included that I think will improve the system.
You said that you've worked for different golf associations around the country. Is there a major difference between each golf association, and what's the purpose of having individual locales having their own golf association?
Well, so much of the work is localized. Most state and regional associations formed, many of them formed more than a century ago, and they form for the purpose of just identifying an amateur champion for their region.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's the top golfer in this area? That's where they all started, you know, again, in some cases more than a century ago. And then as golf evolved and the course rating system and handicap system evolved, that became a role for the state and regional associations. So I've worked for four, and they vary in size, they vary in the staff that they have, but they do all the local work. So, the USGA creates the course rating system, but they don't have the means from back in New Jersey to go out there and do all the work. So we have a volunteer group of almost 50 raters here in Northern California that go out and rate the courses under the USGA system and process them. So we do all the legwork associated with the course rating system. We run the USGA qualifiers, so, U.S. Open local, and we trade off with Southern California every 2 years for U.S. Open sectional. The U.S. Junior Girls Championship is here at Poppy Hills next year, so we run the qualifiers for all the USGA championships, and then we provide the handicap service. So again, the USGA writes the rules and how you crunch the numbers, but we're the ones who supply them. Then on our side, we're fortunate that we own Poppy Hills and Poppy Ridge and are able to offer that to our membership at greatly discounted rates. And I don't know if you've had them on before, but you should. Our foundation, which has the Youth on Course program, which is spreading across the country, where I don't know the latest count. I think we have about 160 or 170 golf courses or so in Northern California where a junior golfer who goes through our Youth on Course curriculum can play 18 holes for $5. Mm-hmm. And that is spreading all across the country, and we hope to make it national, spread to more and more markets. That, the First Tee is a fantastic organization and can introduce the game to kids, but you still have the barrier of cost, and what does a kid do after that? And, the prospect of being able to play a nice golf course for only $5 is very appealing and can, continue someone from the First Tee where they can continue playing golf and become a golfer for life. So that's one of the things that we do, and most other state and regional associations have a charitable side to them that either does, scholarships for kids, caddy scholarships in some parts of the country, turf grass research, things of that nature.
I have a friend who actually started playing golf this year for his high school. And he pretty much started playing golf this year, but he was playing, and he was telling me that he joins the system. He can play any course for $5. He's ecstatic and wants to go out and play more because of that, because of the $5.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just amazed at the program and everything they've done with it. Again, now they have a number of college scholarships. We have our first person ever who's gotten an Evans scholarship, which is going to be full tuition and housing for someone who did a lot of caddying here in Northern California. They have different employment programs. So it's amazing. And then there are some high-profile courses that can play. In my native Washington, they've gotten on board with Youth on Course in Chambers Bay. You can one of the courses that kids during certain hours can play for $5. Here, Poppy Hills is one of them that they can. In Chicago, I believe Cog Hill. So again, it's spreading, and we have all sorts of fundraisers because basically the courses come out winners too. The foundation is subsidizing the cost of the round, the difference between the $5 and what that course would normally charge for a junior on that date and at that time. It's subsidized through the foundation. So we have all sorts of fundraising efforts to keep Youth on Course funded And again, now it's spreading to many, many states.
Well, we've recently did an episode about finding scholarships, getting your kid into a high college golf program. So this would be a nice thing to pursue. I will talk to you later about talking to them on the show as well.
Sure.
Thank you for the tip on that one. So what is the relationship between the local golf associations and the USGA?
Well, again, they're the ones who write the rules. We conduct championships utilizing those rules. They write the rules of handicapping, and we administer them locally. They tell us how to rate a golf course, and then we go out and do that. So it's a very close relationship because it's all about amateur golf. And again, the USGA was formed for the purpose of crowning a national champion, just like we were formed for the purpose of forming a regional champion in different categories. So it's a very close relationship because we serve the same people and we have the same goals in terms of promoting golf and bringing golf to more people.
Excellent. I want to get back to Rating and Slope now. Share with us what you feel are some myths about Rating and Slope and how people use them to determine which tee box they're going to play.
Well, most people fixate, or a lot of people fixate on the slope rating, and they think that that is the primary indicator of difficulty, and it absolutely is not. It's the course rating. So for some reason, people have latched on to that number. They find it's sexy or something like that, and they think, okay, this can't be right. This set of tees is rated 132, and across the street is a course which is much tougher, and it's rated 128. Well, the course rating is the primary number because your scores are compared to the course rating first, how wide a gap between the two, and then the slope rating only tweaks that difference. So course rating is by far the more important number. Another big myth in golf is the number one stroke hole means that's the toughest hole on the golf course. And coincidentally, it might be, but that's not the intention of the allocation of the stroke holes, the ranking of the stroke holes. It's actually designed for match play, not stroke play. So it's not trying to identify the toughest hole on the golf course. It's trying to identify the hole where a high handicapper most needs a stroke in order to secure a halve with a low handicapper in a match. So so that's another big problem. I've gotten a lot of calls recently on, no, we think the difference between the white tee and the blue tee is much greater than the rating because for many of our players, especially middle and high handicappers, they score 5 strokes higher from blue than they do white, and the difference in the rating is only 2 strokes. And, there is such a thing I like to call it as, horses for courses. We all have our relative strengths and weaknesses in our games. There are certain golf courses that set up for us better than others. Two courses might have the identical ratings, and yet, I might play course A much better than B. You might play B better than A. That doesn't mean the ratings are off. It just means that my game, your game, stacks up with one golf course better than the other. And it's the same with tees that, you have a comfort level with a certain set of tees, and now you move back and you tackle one that's 300-400 yards longer. Basically, your scores might go up much more rapidly than a scratch golfer would. And so, it doesn't seem like the handicap system is quite working right. So I always tell people, settle on the set of tees that suits your game best, that you have the most fun from. Don't worry about the other tees. Don't worry about any of that. Just go ahead and enjoy it from there. Your handicap will be, very accurate for that. And then the USGA system is versatile in that a club can conduct a competition and let the white tee players play from white and let the blue tee players play from blue, and you can still have an equitable net competition. So those are some of the things that we get a lot of questions about.
Well, are you saying that when you're looking at the rating slope of course A and the rating slope as a golfer, mm-hmm. and the rating slope of course B, you're not comparing apples to apples?
Well, You know, again, what there's everybody has different strengths and weaknesses, and one course may set up better for golfer A than the other. So what I'm saying is that the course and slope rating system, you know, it's not going to be perfect for every single golfer. There are going to be some golfers you instinctively or for whatever reason you play better than others. Again, it doesn't mean the rating is off. It is good in general, though, again, to get an idea on the relative difficulty of the golf course and what you're going to be facing that day. Looking at the ratings will give you some clue. Looking at the yardage will certainly give you some clue. But it's dangerous trying to compare course ratings from A and B and go something's off because clearly this course is more difficult than the other. Well, it might be for a 10 handicapper, might be for a 20 handicapper, but it probably isn't for scratch. So it can be dangerous trying to compare ratings going, oh, that means that this one is definitely more difficult than the other. And then, you know, yeah, again, you have to see how your game stacks up against them.
So I still don't have an idea of what I should be looking at. You're saying yardage when I go to a new course that I've not played on determining what tee boxes that I'm going to choose or what are the better tee boxes suited for my game other than yardage?
Well, I mean, that's one aspect, but I'm going to weigh yardage with the ratings. Again, I'm going to have, you know, most people have some comfort level in general with a certain distance for the, you know, yardage for the 18 holes. Because if there's a certain distance, that's implying, you know, hey, there's going to be some holes I can reach in regulation. Now, if you want to look at it in more detail, then look at, you know, the lengths of the individual holes and try to get some idea on, you know, your comfort level with a lot of those individual hole lengths. So, again, that's part of it. There's a program that the PGA of America and the USGA introduced a few years ago called Tee It
Play
Forward.
It Forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And they tried to, you know, say, if you hit your tee ball about this far, here in general is the length of set of tees you ought to be looking at and considering playing. And it's interesting, you know, to try to get the same experience that a tour player does in terms of what clubs they have for an approach shot into a green. And it's a little shocking that says if you hit your driver about 200 yards, you should maybe be looking at some tees between 5,200 and 5,400 yards to play. Most people, they probably think that seems a little bit short. So it's interesting how they developed that and how they came up with it. So, again, yardage would be a part.
It didn't really catch on, though, very well.
Well, yes and no. We certainly are seeing an outpouring of clubs asking for men's ratings from non-traditional tees, men's ratings from red tees now, developing combo tees somewhere between red and white. A lot of courses are putting in family tees that maybe are only 4,000 yards. In the Bay Area, I ran into a course where a golfer was just curious what I was doing, and I told him, well, they're putting in, you know, they have some family tees, and we're measuring and rating for them. And he said, oh, I love those tees. I play with my grandkids on the weekends from those tees. So we're seeing a lot more of that. And we're seeing more and more clubs offering their tournaments where, you know, the golfer chooses the set of tees that they want to play from, and then there's an adjustment within the course rating, within the handicap system, that's going to allow you to have an equitable competition, taking into account that not everybody is playing the same set of tees. So we don't hear a lot about Tee It Forward specifically, but I think the message has come home, especially in California, probably more so here than many parts of the country. But now when we go rate a course, and we like to rate a course every 6 years, in the past they only wanted a men's rating from blue and white. Well, now they want a men's rating from gold and red as well, because there's a demand by their membership for a rating to develop a handicap from those shorter tees. So that's very encouraging, very healthy. I always applaud it when we see it when we're rating. There used to be a stigma against men playing from red tees that red meant women, and you can't do that. And now we're seeing that becoming much more common. And some of our raters have latched on to that. After we rate the golf course in the morning, when we play in the afternoon to get to get confirmation on the green speeds or the difficulty of the greens and everything, a lot of our raters have just said, "Nope, I'm moving up to the red tees. I've heard the message, I've taken it to heart, and I'm moving up." And they enjoy golf more. It was getting they were getting beat up by the longer tees, and now they're finding a set of tees that works well for them and maximizes their enjoyment.
Unfortunately, ego is such a big factor in golf that it's hard for so many people. I personally, I'm like, look, I'm not going to shoot par today. I'm out here to have a good time and do the best score I can. So I don't mind playing the white tees, guys. You can move up.
Right.
We don't have to play in the middle of the back ones. It's okay. We're still going to have fun out here. No reason to beat yourself up.
Well, the first time it really sunk in with me, I remember being on a golf on a business trip and took a couple days of vacation. A friend flew out and we played a golf course in Chicago. And before we teed it up, this golf course had hosted a major championship, and I'd seen it on TV. And before teed it up, my friend and I were both good golfers at that time. We looked it up and we go, I don't want to play it all the way back. It's just, again, it's too many 450-yard par fours to be fun. So we moved up a set, and we were paired with a father-son, and their handicaps were probably 20-plus, and they played it all the way back. And after a few holes, they saw us hitting reasonably good shots, and they're going, hey, how come you're not back here with us? And we said, well, this is the set of tees that we think we're going to have fun from, that's going to be just the right challenge for us. And they said, not us. We want to get our money's worth. And their money's worth meant they could not reach any greens in regulation. They're hitting woods on all the par threes. And that was one of the first rounds where it really sunk in, where I recognized my own limitations instead of instinctively going to some back tees at that time, and just said, no, I got a reasonable chance from here. I have some holes where I might have a scoring club in my hand when I approach the green. I have some where I have mid irons. I have some longer ones. And that's really what I'm looking for is, I like a golf course where at the end of the day, I can figure I hit almost every club in the bag that one way or another, I got to hit short irons, mid irons, longer shots, perhaps into the greens.
So I guess for a lot of people, if they want to get their money's worth, it's like they want to have the the least amount of cost per stroke,
right,
as opposed to the highest amount of cost
right.
per stroke,
right,
which should be the goal. You talked about the Raiders, and that's how you and I got together. My friend Steve has been a Raider for the NCGA for a while. What kind of training does it take to become a course Raider for the NCGA, and is that a paid position?
No, they're volunteers. And,
yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, so what does it take to become one?
Well, we start off with a 3-day seminar just introducing the basics, and it's really information overkill. The course rating system is... it's a very intimidating to people, and yet it's based on common sense. So, if you have out of bounds that's marked by stakes, there's a lot greater chance the ball is going to go out of bounds than if it's marked by a cyclone fence or a stone wall. And if there's a cart path that's right adjacent to that out of bounds, that's going to contribute to balls going out. So a lot of it has to do with that. So we start off with training. We really think it takes a couple of years for someone to start getting to really get the gist of it. We require that someone, we feel that they must rate a minimum of five courses per year to acquire the skills, and then five courses a year to maintain those skills. So it's really going over the characteristics of the scratch golfer, how far they hit it, same with bogey, and it's just learning what we do. We go out to the landing zone and we take a number of measurements. How wide is the fairway again? How far is it to the lateral water hazard? Are there some factors that are going to keep the ball from going in the hazard, or is there a slope that's going to make it more likely they go into play? Things like that. Just learning the 9 different obstacles that we're rating for and the 5 different distance obstacles that we're rating for. So, it's almost rare that by the end of the first season, a newbie would, really be pulling their own weight. But they enjoy it, and they, a lot of them will study up during the winter and come back the next year, determined to carry their own weight. And, then we have a lot of mentoring by raiders. Steve retired this year, but he was a mentor to a lot of the new raiders in that particular area where you pair up a captain, an experienced person, with a newbie to kind of learn the ropes.
Well, this is what I love about podcasting. That somebody can listen to this conversation and go back and listen to it again. There's so much really important information that you've given us, and it's pretty dense, at least for me. I know that I'm going to need to go back and take notes again on some of the things you said so I can understand it better. But I really appreciate your time, Jim. This has been so fascinating because for years I've wanted to know what we're talking about with the rating and slope, and I've heard so many different descriptions and definitions of what slope is that I'm just grateful for the work that you do, but also for coming on and explaining to us.
Okay, well, my pleasure.
Okay, now do you know which tee boxes you're playing from? Yeah, a little clearer. At least it is for me. Hey, if you're new to Golf Smarter, thank you for checking us out and welcome. And if you're returning after being away for the off season or even longer, welcome back. I just want to let you know that some changes have been made recently, and now all Golf Smarter episodes are free for everyone so that you can listen to a complete episode or what was exclusive to premium subscribers since 2009. So for many podcasts, I can see where that may not work well. You don't want to go back to old episodes. But golf instruction hasn't changed much since we began doing this show in 2005. So I invite you, go to golfsmarter.com. Review our archives page. Can I say that properly? Review our archives page. Find a topic or a teacher that interests you and download any and all episodes that pique your interest. I promise, even if you've heard that episode before, you are going to hear things that you may not have made sense to you then, but could be an aha moment today. The easiest way to access all Golf Smarter episodes is by downloading the free Golf Smarter app for iOS or Android. But, of course, you can subscribe for free in iTunes, the Apple Podcasts app, Overcast, or wherever you find your favorite podcast. Please follow us at Golf Smarter on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or, of course, at golfsmarter.com.